Coming up next, from the movie Romero, Archbishop Oscar Romero orders the army to stop the repression of the people.
I'd like to make an appeal in a special way to the men in the army. Brothers, each one of you is one of us. We are the same people. The farmers and peasants that you kill are your own brothers and sisters. When you hear the words of a man telling you to kill, think instead in the words of God, "Thou shalt not kill." No soldier is obliged to obey an order contrary to the law of God. In his name, and in the name of our tormented people who have suffered so much and whose laments cry out to heaven, I implore you, I beg you, I order you, stop the repression!
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can listen to this program and other wonderful programs at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area. And today's program, if you're just tuning in, is America's Path to Permanent War. Andrew Bacevich, an international relations professor at Boston University, says now is the time to examine the Washington consensus on national security. He argues that national priorities must shift from fixing Afghanistan to fixing Detroit.
This has been so interesting. Thank you so much. My name is Susan Rudin, and my question is, the New York City Police Department has offices in almost every major city of the world, which I don't know exactly what they do, but I think they're fact-finding for the protection of New York City. Is that a model for what you would consider for Washington? And do other cities have the same kind of outreach into Rome? Amsterdam, you know, Berlin.
Ma'am, I honestly don't know. I did not know that the New York City Police Department had that kind of a presence. Yeah. I would assume that it's a liaison function with foreign intelligence services to try to facilitate the exchange of information that somehow suggests that there is a pending threat to New York. I didn't know that happened, and I don't know what my opinion would be. I mean, frankly, if every major city in the United States had a police liaison to every foreign capital, I'm afraid that the result would be to clog things up rather than to facilitate this exchange of intelligence that I would presume would be the idea. I was not aware of that. My wife and I are definitely aware of the fact that you sure have a lot of cops in this city. Just coming from Penn Station today, they are just... And it's a very, if you're not from here, truly, you probably sort of get used to it. But the police presence is, I know it's the UN thing, but I mean, the police presence is just striking.
And Obama seems to be too.
Right.
Sylvan?
Tell us an Ernest King story.
No.
But one where you cannot use any colorful language.
Every time he came into the chart room, the war room, I had to turn the fan off because he was bald. He didn't like a draft on his head. Thank you very much for a wonderful speech, and thank you for your kind words about me. I'd like to go back to Eisenhower 101. Beware the military-industrial complex. And we got into trouble, and he also warned about being involved on the mainland of Asia. And we got involved, and we screwed up, and McNamara finally had to write a mea culpa about how he was wrong about everything. Interventionism. Would you say interventionism is higher on the East Coast here than in other parts of the country? We seem to have a mindset in the East Coast here that's totally different from the mindset on the West Coast.
Well, I don't know. There are certainly, I think there's a general perception among historians that back in the time of your youth, there was a greater enthusiasm for intervention on the coasts than there was in what we today call the heartland. That's where my wife and I grew up, in the heartland. When I was a kid, I read the Chicago Tribune when Colonel McCormick, a fantastic but forgotten, somewhat weird figure, was a long-term publisher of the Chicago Tribune. And he was, quite frankly, an isolationist. And to some degree, McCormick's isolationism did, I think, reflect a skepticism in the Midwest that was very much part of the Midwest at that time.
And anti-British.
Also anti-British. In certain quarters, anti-Semitic. My own sense is today, whether or not these regional... my guess would be the regional distinctions are not as sharp as they once were. And yet, I think that there are elements of that Midwestern anti-interventionist tradition. Some elements. Not the anti-Semitic piece of it. But there was a skepticism about whether or not we had the capacity to remake the world. Frankly, an aversion to big armies that I think was part of this then regional tradition that we ought to revisit today. Not on a regional basis, but that as Americans we can recognize. If the Midwestern tradition lost the argument in the latter half of the 20th century, by the time we get to the post-World War II period, everybody is an internationalist. So if they lost the argument in the second half of the 20th century, the fact that they lost the argument doesn't mean that every point that they were making was illegitimate. So it seems to me today we might want to revisit that tradition and to discern whether or not there's any anything to be salvaged. I wrote a review essay, it was 6 months ago now. I wrote a review. I got a review essay coming out later this month in a journal called Raritan. It's published at Rutgers. About a group of Midwestern historians who, all of them deceased now, who I think said things that ought to resonate today. And what they were saying really reflected a wariness of globalism, a wariness of having a determination to save the world actually become a pretext for imperial behavior. I think those are sentiments that still have a place.
Can I just take these two last questions together and then the last word? If you want.
My name is Mike Sponda. This would be a philosophical one under Washington rules. If the Heritage Foundation was smart enough to invite you to one of their meetings, how do you think that the questions would come to you, and what kind of people would you be addressing to, because they are Washington rules under your definition?
Well, I'm sorry.
Okay. I wanted to ask what I see a problem. I could be wrong. There's a resurgent militant form of Islam, which is dragging in its wake other forms of atavistic tribal belief and behavior. I understand the reservations and the problems with our current courses of action that we're pursuing to deal with this problem, but I wonder if you agree with me at all that this is a real problem and not just a chimera or something that maybe pops up on the radar screen, hopefully once a decade or so. What do we do about it if we don't do what we're doing now?
Well, on the first point, the Heritage Foundation is not going to invite me to come talk to them. So, they would find all of this disagreeable and probably not worth serious consideration. I would want to, in terms of the threat, I would want to distinguish between two different elements. The first element is the existence of terrorist networks, with Al-Qaeda being probably the prime example. Emphatically, it is a threat. It's not an existential threat. The notion that Al-Qaeda, that Osama bin Laden is going to create some new caliphate and take over the entire Islamic world and embark upon some global jihad is preposterous, because what he has on offer actually has, I think, fairly limited appeal to the 1.4 billion people of the Islamic world. So it's important to recognize that Al-Qaeda is a threat. It is important not to overstate that threat. I think that the notion created by the George W. Bush administration that the best way to deal with this threat is to invade and occupy countries, waging open-ended war, is demonstrably not going to produce success, and that the argument that many people, I think, have now made, that we should view it as a police problem, has great merit, an international police problem, a mafia that in one way or another draws some of its energy by warping a religious tradition. Piece number one. Piece number two is this larger crisis in the Islamic world, where it does, speaking as somebody who has minimal expertise with regard to Islam, it really does seem to me that there is that within the Islamic world, there's a great crisis, the root of which is the challenge of reconciling a particular religious tradition with modernity. How can I be a faithful Muslim and also live in the Islamic world, live in the modern world? And that this posed significant challenges in what used to be called Christendom a couple hundred years ago and led to a considerable amount of violence in the West, has been mostly resolved, but not entirely resolved in the West. If we look at Reverend Terry, Mr. International Burn a Quran Day. And I think that it's going to take a considerable period of time for this crisis to be resolved in the Islamic world, and they're going to have to do it on their own. Indeed, I would say that to the extent that we interfere in their affairs and basically assert that we can fix their problems, we probably make things worse. Because the appearance is, whether we wish to acknowledge it or not, is that we are simply infidels who are continuing the behavior of Western imperial powers in the Islamic world for a couple of centuries. There, I think, the response is to re-envision a strategy of containment that will insulate us from any effects of this internal crisis as it plays itself out. And that's a strategy of containment that doesn't look like the strategy of containment that was put together during the Cold War, but it's based on the same expectation that the problem will resolve itself over a long period of time because internal contradictions on the other side will sort themselves out. That's also a strategy that says we're going to live with this problem for a very considerable period of time.
Access Sacramento broadcasts great speeches and interviews every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., or you can get the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Crossfire. Tonight, two men who haven't spoken to each other in 25 years, Ariel Sharon and Yasser Arafat.
You don't bring me flowers. You don't send me emails. We don't even try to talk anymore. You don't call me from your compound when you're held under siege. I remember when you'd yell at me each morning. You'd issue me a warning. Now you don't even write. You send tanks in instead. You avoid all my calls and hide under your bed. And I'm getting dust bunnies all over my head.
Oh, poopsie.
You don't let me shower anymore.
You got mud on Powell.
I let him use my towel. Our meetings last year didn't get very far. Why'd you miss our last summit? You blew up my car. You smashed my nicest vase, so I didn't shave for Oslo. I don't know how it started, let's try to think back. Well, your great-great-grandfather once planned an attack. It's been thousands of years, who could ever keep track? No one can remember anymore. I must say, Arafat, you're a pain in the rear. And I won't be inviting you out for a beer. But admit, in a way, that I've saved your career. Please, Yasir, don't retire. When we're exchanging fire, our polls at home grow higher evermore. No!
Coming up next, from the movie Ali. Ali defends his decision not to participate in the military draft induction, delivered by Will Smith.
I ain't draft dodging, I ain't burning no flag, and I ain't running to Canada. I'm staying right here. You want to send me to jail? Fine, you go right ahead. I've been in jail for 400 years. I could be there for four or five more. But I ain't going no 10,000 miles to help murder and kill other poor people. If I want to die, I'll die right here, right now, fighting you. If I want to die, you my enemy, not no Chinese, no Viet Cong, no Japanese. You my poser when I want freedom. You my poser when I want justice. You my poser when I want equality. Want me to go somewhere and fight for you? You won't even stand up for me right here in America, for my rights and my religious beliefs. You won't even stand up for me right here at home.
Coming up next, Winston Churchill gives his Iron Curtain speech in 1946 at a small college in Fulton, Missouri. Winston Churchill was twice the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom.
Last time, I saw it all coming, and I cried aloud to my own fellow countrymen and to the world, but no one paid any attention. Up till the year 1933, or even 1935, Germany might have been saved from the awful fate which had overtaken her. And we might all have been spared the miseries Hitler let loose upon mankind. There never was a war in history easier to prevent by timely action than the one which had just desolated such great areas of the globe. It could have been prevented, in my belief, without the firing of a single shot. And Germany might be powerful, prosperous, and honored today. But no one would listen. And one by one, we were all sucked into the awful whirlpool. Miss Shirley, ladies and gentlemen, I put it to you, surely we must not let that happen again. From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent. Behind that line lie all the capitals of the ancient states of Central and Eastern Europe. Warsaw, Berlin, Prague, Vienna, Budapest, Belgrade, Bucharest, and Sofia. All these famous cities and the populations around them lie in what I must call the Soviet sphere. What is needed is a settlement. And the longer this is delayed, the more difficult it will be, and the greater our dangers will become. From what I have seen of our Russian friends and allies during the war, I am convinced that there is nothing they admire so much as strength, and there is nothing for which they have less respect than for weakness, especially military weakness.
Jesse Jackson, running for the Democratic nomination in 1984, addresses a crowd at Tenley Baptist Church in Philadelphia.
Eight Democrats running for the nomination. Hello. This time around, you got a chance, and you got a choice. You want somebody who marched for you to get the right to vote, you got a choice. You want somebody who challenged corporate America to hire you and give you contracts, you got a choice. It's choice time. All this talk about qualification. What do blacks know about foreign policy? It's an insult. Yeah.
preacher.
I was 3 years old. I came into my consciousness. My daddy was coming home from the war. Foreign policy. If he was so dumb, how'd he get over there and get back? If he didn't know foreign policy, why'd they give him a gun? And when they gave it to him, he knew which way to shoot. We know foreign policy. When you buy a Honda and Toyota, that's foreign policy.
That's right.
Russian vodka, that's foreign policy. Panasonic and Sony, that's foreign policy. Mercedes-Benz, that's foreign policy. As a matter of fact, we came here on a foreign policy. I know y'all in a hurry. I'm going to leave you now. It's time for a new course, a new coalition, a new leadership. Somebody got to rise above race, rise above sex, a new leadership, a choice, a chance. Don't cry by what you don't have. Use what you got. Reagan won the last time, not by genius. Reagan won when we were asleep. He won by the margin of despair. He won by the margin, the fracture of our coalition. He won by the margin of racial division. He won by default. I close with another story. There's a little shepherd boy named David.
All right, sir.
Everybody in town was scared of Goliath. Philadelphia, your time has come. Don't stop at the mayor's office. Go on higher. Because you must never forget that about the time we began to take over cities, Nixon shifted the power to the suburbs. And now Reagan shifted it to the states. So you got mayors with more and more responsibility and less power. We've got more and more folk and fewer services. We cannot stop. We got to rise on higher. Little David. Little David. Little David. Took off his unnecessary garments. Little David. Didn't want to get weighted down with a lot of foolishness. Little David took what God gave him, a slingshot and a God biscuit, a rock. Our problem today is, David, we need to organize Pennsylvania and win because we're going to stop the rocks. It's been laying around and pick them up.
That's right.
In 1980, Reagan won Massachusetts by 2,500 votes.
Yeah.
There were over 100,000 students unregistered. Over 50,000 blacks, over 50,000 Hispanics. He won by 2,500. Ted Kennedy's state. Rocks just laying around. He won Illinois by 300,000 votes. 800,000 unregistered blacks, 500,000 Hispanics. Rocks.
Rocks.
Just laying around. He won in 1980. 3 million high school students unregistered to vote. Now they've been registered to draft. Rocks. Just laying around. 11 million college students who could have chosen jobs over jails, peace over war, that didn't vote. Now they're crying. Rocks. Just laying around. Reagan won 8 southern states by 182,000 votes. But that was 3 million unregistered blacks in them same 8 states. Rocks. Just laying around. He won New York by 165,000 votes. 600,000 students unregistered. 900,000 blacks. 600,000 Hispanics. Rocks. Just laying around. 1980, Reagan won Pennsylvania by 300,000 votes. 400,000 students unregistered. More than 600,000 blacks unregistered. Reagan won Pennsylvania by the margin of despair. by the margin, the fracture of our coalition. Your time has come. Pick up your slingshot. Pick up your rock. Declare our time has come. A new day has begun. Red, yellow, black, and white, we're all precious in God's sight. Our time has come.
Hello? Hello, is this the Undertakers?
Yeah, that's right, that's right. What can we do for you?
Well, my mother has just died, and I'm not quite sure what to do with her.
Well, there's three things we do with your mum. We can burn her, bury her, or dump her.
Dump her?
Yes, in the Thames.
What?
Oh, did you like her?
Yes.
Oh, well, we won't dump her then. Well, we can burn her or bury her.
Well, which would you recommend?
Well, they're both nasty. If we burn her, she gets stuffed in the flames, crackle, 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 which is a bit of a shock if she's not quite dead, but quick, and then we give you a box of ashes which you can pretend are hers. Or, if you don't want to fry her, you can bury her, and then she gets eaten up by maggots and weevils, nibble, 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 which isn't so hot if, as I said, she's not quite dead.
I'm not quite sure she's dead. Where is she? She's in this sack.
Let's have a look. Oh, she looks quite young.
Yes, she was.
Fred, I think we've got an eater.
I'll get the oven on.
Excuse me. Are you proposing to eat my mother?
Yeah, not raw, not raw. Cook it, she'd be delicious with a few french fries, a bit of stuff in the broccoli, delicious.
I couldn't. Well, actually, I do feel a bit peckish.
No, I couldn't. I'll tell you what, we'll eat your mum, then if you feel a bit guilty about it afterwards, we'll dig a grave and you can throw up into it.
Coming soon to a DVD near you.
That's all, folks.